Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we take a monumental stack of sources, articles, research, and insights, and we really try to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge or insight, giving you a shortcut to being instantly well-informed. I'm King.
And I'm Gail. Our mission for you today is a fascinating one. We are peeling back the curtain on a specific, deeply chaotic, yet structurally rigid online universe.
Okay.
We are summarizing the life and stories of Big Fatty Online, or BFO, drawing heavily from a very specific and, well, dramatic week of his episodes in April 2008. And we're grounding all of that chaos in a necessary historical context provided by the show Ruination, the early years.
Okay, let's unpack this a little bit. We are setting the stage for BFO as this unique universe, right? An ecosystem built entirely on what feels like a profound structural paradox.
It really is.
On the one hand, this man's daily existence is governed by these remarkably stable, almost, you know, ritualistic routines. He's predictable. But on the other, that very predictability, that extreme consistency, provides the reliable canvas for the most intimate, chaotic, vulgar, and genuinely ruined moments of his life to be shared daily.
That framing is absolutely essential. I mean, without it, the show just doesn't make any sense. The stability, the known route of the daily walk, the fixed 20-minute daily format, the scheduled shopping trips, that is the anchor.
Right.
And it's only because that anchor is so firmly set that the host feels completely secure enough to share the most vulnerable, unfiltered, and often deeply embarrassing details of his life. So we're going to trace exactly how that tension between ironclad structure and radical personal chaos define the content and the community this particular week.
It's the performance of consistency that enables the performance of chaos.
That's it.
It's brilliant.
It is.
So nothing sets the tone for BFO quite like the complete lack of a filter. Let's start this deep dive with the unfiltered host and the soundscape. Because if you are new to the world of BFO, you need to understand that this host will share absolutely everything, including the sounds that come from him, both, you know, natural and technological.
And this specific week of April 2008 started with a bang. Or maybe more like a trumpet solo.
A trumpet solo.
Yeah. On April 14th, he started the show by directly admitting, live on the recording, to having loudly passed gas while setting up the equipment.
That is the ultimate breaking of the fourth wall. I mean, it's a literal audible demolition of the barrier between the performer and the audience.
Precisely. And the context of the admission is key here. He was sort of musing about the show's low fidelity nature, you know, wondering if listeners could hear him munching on popcorn during the recording process.
Okay.
And he realized that if the mic picked up the popcorn, it almost certainly picked up what he just casually termed his trumpet solo.
Wow.
So this sets the low production intimate tone immediately.
And the humor response turns this, you know, potentially really embarrassing moment into an interactive communal event.
Yes, he immediately turned it into a direct challenge. He encouraged listeners, right then and there, to rewind the file, and we're talking about the early days of file downloads here.
Right, this is 2008.
Exactly. And listen closely for any sound that vaguely resembled the opening chorus to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He weaponizes the mundane embarrassment.
What's so fascinating about that challenge is that it serves two functions, right? It gives you a moment of immediate shocking intimacy, but it also establishes the trust that he has with his listeners.
Mm-hmm.
They are co-conspirators in the chaos, and he trusts them not to judge him, but to, you know, participate in the joke.
That trust is the currency of the show. It establishes that the host is the soundscape, and he's basically telling you, I am recording this in my raw, natural environment, and you're going to hear everything because that's the point.
Right. If you're looking for slick, high-gloss production,
you are in the wrong place.
You were in the wrong place. But as we establish, this radical chaos is immediately, always, balanced by this rigid commitment to ritual and structure.
Oh.
Even in the show's early days, that structure was non-negotiable. And it begins with these content rituals.
The ritual begins with the theme music test. This week, he played the famously, notoriously long opening song from the children's television show HR Pump Stuff.
Okay.
And it wasn't just background noise.
No, it's a genuine test.
It is. He challenged the listeners to join in singing what is without a doubt the longest opening music for any television show. So this isn't passive consumption. It's an insistence on shared cultural knowledge.
Right.
It forces the listener to commit to this slightly obscure, deep cut nostalgia. It's almost like a barrier to entry, a shared rite of passage that separates the casual listener from the committed BFO family.
It creates instant in-group status. If you know the lyrics and you're willing to sing along, it says, we know this niche thing together.
Absolutely. And the commitment to community was also structural, defined by these recurring, meticulously detailed contact rituals. He had to constantly remind everyone of the specific, crucial ways to connect and, you know, feed the content beast.
Which were specific, archaic by today's standards, but memorable.
Oh, yeah. You could leave comments on the website, which was simply bigfatonline.com, and he always made sure to specify no www needed.
Right.
Or you could email him at ruined@bigfatonline.com, emphasizing the concept that the show was built around their shared ruined lives.
And the most important conduit for the chaos was that voice letter number. What was it?
It was 206-337-1438. That phone line was the lifeblood of the show, and he constantly pushed to keep it full of fresh, listener-driven voices.
Which leads directly to this non-podcaster idea that he championed during this week. He pushed hard for the following week to feature only listener calls, making a deliberate effort to exclude his network peers and fellow industry acquaintances.
Yeah.
Why do you think that boundary was so important to him? I mean, he's clearly connected to these peers, their neighbors, their friends, but he actively tries to push them out of the content stream for a week.
I think it's a defense mechanism for authenticity. He intuitively understood that if the show became dominated by inside baseball and network gossip, which, you know, it often was, it would dilute the raw, honest, ruined nature of the content coming from the actual audience.
Okay.
Listeners like Tim even called in specifically to champion this idea, supporting the move to keep the focus on the general public.
It's a fascinating, deliberate choice. He was, in a sense, protecting the show's amateur, authentic core against the risk of becoming just another industry echo chamber.
Exactly.
He wanted the raw voices of the people who were tuning in purely for the content, not just his colleagues cross-promoting.
And that decision cemented BFO's identity as a show for the listener, not for the podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
That structural boundary, you know, insisting on listener-driven content, was essential to ensuring the radical intimacy held true and that the content felt immediate and real, not curated by some production schedule.
Right.
The fact that he was willing to tell his friends, you don't count this week, speaks volumes about his commitment to the audience over the industry.
And that commitment to authenticity is even more startling when you realize the highly sophisticated and professional background of the man delivering this raw, unedited chaos. So here's where it gets really interesting. In these early episodes, Big Fatty doesn't just talk about today. He reveals an incredible amount of biographical detail. He charts his life before he became the personality we know.
He does.
So let's start with his academic and stage career. We're talking about a classically trained, highly academic background, aren't we?
Absolutely. The man who's encouraging people to rewind and listen for a flatulent sound effect has a surprisingly rigorous academic history. He majored in French literature and theater studies while he was in college in Connecticut.
Wow.
And that dual focus language and performance is actually crucial to understanding his later persona.
And that education led directly to a job he very quickly realized was soul crushing.
Laughing, yeah. He taught French for exactly 1 year right after graduation. This was at a K-12 girls' school housed in an Upper East Side townhouse in New York City. And the workload, by his own account, was just horrific.
Okay, detail that workload because it paints a picture of extreme stress.
Well, he was completely overloaded.
Mm-hmm.
He taught sixth grade French. He served as a homeroom teacher for the seventh grade.
Okay.
And he was also responsible for teaching 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade French.
Ooh.
That's five different curricula plus homeroom responsibilities. He bluntly admitted he hated it. And the workload, especially the grading, was just too much for a new graduate.
It's fascinating because it forces a rapid pivot. He quickly transitions into the career he actually trained for, acting. He recounts a decade-long acting career after moving to New York specifically to be a Broadway performer.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't a fling. This was a serious commitment.
10 years is an eternity in the performing arts world. And he clarifies this wasn't 10 years spent mostly waiting tables. He insists he was always doing something. He performed in several national tours, regional theater, small films. he always managed to sustain himself professionally. And that speaks to genuine talent and tenacity.
So let's highlight those key roles, because this sounds like a real professional theater background that contrasts so sharply with the lo-fi podcasting persona.
Well, his professional history is surprisingly prestigious. He recounted his favorite experience playing Ramon, the naked Latino on the raft, in Terrence McNally's acclaimed ensemble play, Love, Valor, Compassion.
Wow.
He described that specific run as being incredibly fun and artistically fulfilling.
But the truly star-studded anecdote involves sharing the stage with theatrical legends.
Yes, this is perhaps the most humbling experience he relates. He was part of the jury in a production of Inherit the Wind, starring George C. Scott and Charles Durney.
Oh, wow.
For 8 shows a week, he was sitting there, quietly observing and performing alongside these iconic figures. He shared that proximity to true professionalism and that kind of rigor, that respect for performance. It must inform his commitment to his current 20-minute daily show structure.
That's a profound connection. The discipline required for Broadway is now repurposed into the discipline required for daily unscripted content creation.
Exactly. The consistency of the acting schedule, you know, 8 shows a week, rehearsal schedules, it's just replaced by the consistency of the daily show schedule. It's the same structural foundation applied to a different medium.
So after 10 years of working steadily, which is a success story in the theater world, he makes the conscious decision to pivot again and become a chef.
Wow.
Why? This seems like such a massive break.
It was a very proactive and philosophical decision. He wanted to leave acting before he started hating it. He'd seen too many colleagues become these bitter, awful, miserable people, you know, actors who stayed too long and couldn't handle the grind, the constant rejection, or the lack of creative control.
He left to preserve his spirit.
He left on his own terms, and he notes that by leaving on good terms, he felt he could potentially return to the stage later in life, maybe in an amateur or directing capacity, or maybe even professionally once his culinary and now his online notoriety grew. It was a strategic self-preservation move.
And his culinary philosophy is rooted entirely in self-teaching, which, you know, it echoes his deep dive approach to podcasting.
He explicitly states, "I did not go to culinary," which is a key detail. His cooking skills are entirely self-taught, stemming from a lifelong intense passion for food.
Right.
And he connects this back to his intellectual style, saying if he were passionate about the Transformers, he'd be a self-taught Transformer expert. It shows that he approaches cooking with the same intense, curious, deep dive methodology that he applies to historical cartoons or reality TV.
What's also fascinating is how he weaves his current NYC geography and his complex family history into the show, turning these intimate details into public knowledge.
He maps out his neighborhood with surveyor-like specificity, which is rare for someone who values privacy, yet he seems to value intimacy more. He lives in this L formation relative to 2 other key figures in the network, Eric and David B.
He places himself precisely.
He lives about a block and a half away from Eric, who lives to his east, and another block and a half from David B., who lives to his south. Hmm. They are all physically intertwined, which explains why they're so often in each other's business and content. It grounds the local gossip in tangible geography.
And finally, that complex family structure is key to understanding the cultural backdrop of his humor.
Yeah, his parents are divorced, and he has a slightly older brother, only 10 months older, with whom he shared his childhood. Then there's this generational gap with his much younger half-brother, who was born when Big Fatty graduated college.
Right.
Which leads him to joke that the boy could be my son. And then you add to that a stepbrother and a stepsister from his father's remarriage, and you have this large, blended, multifaceted family unit.
And the roots are planted firmly outside of New York.
Yes. He confirms almost all of his large extended family lives in New Mexico. He describes them as a big Spanish family with dozens of cousins, and that huge population density, that huge sense of Southern Western roots, it contrasts so sharply with his highly contained, fast-paced New York City life.
Absolutely.
That duality, the urban professional theater background mixed with the expansive Spanish Southern family structure, must deeply inform his comedic voice and his references.
It provides the highbrow reference point, French literature, but the grounding comes from the big Spanish family and the polite Southern manners that we hear pop up in his language constantly. That synthesis is truly unique.
It explains the specific blend of vulgarity and unexpected politeness that characterizes the show. He can jump from a detailed discussion of bodily functions straight into a piece of specific, obscure theatrical trivia.
Okay, let's pivot to the 2 reliable content pillars that filled his daily 20-minute slot during this period. The first is his obsession with quiz programs, as he calls them. We know them as reality TV.
Right.
And the second is the deep well of TV nostalgia. Mm.
The reality TV obsession in April 2008 was dominating the airwaves, particularly with Big Brother 9. And BFO was not just watching, he was emotionally and aesthetically invested in the drama.
He wasn't just observing the game. He was furious at the lack of quality entertainment provided by the contestants.
Oh, he was pissed off about the eviction of James, the contestant who was known for his pink mohawk. Mm-hmm. BFO didn't just see him as a player. He viewed James as the only good player, the only one that was interesting to look at, the only one who had a half a brain.
Wow.
So James's eviction, in BFO's view, meant the show was functionally no more interesting because the entertainment value had just plummeted.
Wait, BFO is constantly performing chaos himself, yet he gets pissed off when the chaos in reality TV doesn't align with his specific high dramatic taste. Isn't that a huge contradiction?
It is, and it's a brilliant insight into his persona. He understands the mechanics of performance. Mm. He views reality TV through the lens of a theater director or critic. He doesn't want manufactured drama. He wants theatrically sound drama. And when the best characters leave, the plot weakens. His anger is rooted in aesthetics.
And that anger was immediately refocused, targeting another contestant with a very specific dismissive nickname.
He was then openly rooting for the potential eviction of Natalie, whom he immediately nicknamed Miss Team Christ. And his underlying motivation was, again, pure showmanship. If Natalie left, he might actually watch it till the end.
Right.
For BFO, reality TV is not about morality or strategy. It's about dramatic potential and whether the contestants are worthy of his precious time and attention.
He also gave his weekly assessment of American Idol Season 7, another huge content driver, and he proclaimed his aesthetic appreciation for one particular contestant.
Yes, the focus was David Archuleta. He openly proclaimed him to be a cutie pie, and then he immediately acknowledged the potential creep factor by admitting that he might be a dirty old man for saying it.
Yeah.
He then confidently predicted that the final three contestants would be the three remaining boys, a prediction based purely on his aesthetic assessment and gut feeling about how America would vote, not necessarily on vocal performance.
It's the confidence of the aesthetic expert. He knows what makes good television, and he's projecting his taste onto the audience.
Exactly. And then we have the utter disappointment surrounding his summer trip and The Price is Right, a story that perfectly encapsulates BFO's meticulous planning colliding with bureaucratic reality.
This ruined not just an hour of his day, but his entire summer travel plan.
It ruined the theatricality of his vacation. He was traveling to the San Francisco Palm Springs area in July, and he had a specific day targeted July 14th. On that day, he planned to wear a special shirt that he believed, in his detailed planning, would guarantee him a spot on Contestants Row.
The ritual of the special shirt?
It was his key to success.
But corporate reality, in the form of Fremantle Media, was indifferent to his ritualistic planning.
They weren't taping on his target date. This disappointment led to him declaring he would give the entire production company, Fremantle Media, the finger for ruining his meticulously planned, ritualistic chance at Contestants Row. The amount of emotional energy invested in wearing the correct shirt on the correct day, only to be thwarted by a scheduling conflict. It shows how deeply his routines, even future ones, become content.
So moving from reality TV analysis to cultural literacy, let's discuss the Memory Lane music segment, which was another content engine based on nostalgia. This week was a deep dive into classic cartoons.
The response to this segment was overwhelmingly positive, reinforcing that sense of shared cultural history with the audience. After playing the theme to Mighty Mouse, he was genuinely shocked by the level of listener engagement. He noted that so many of you love the Mighty Mouse had tattoos and t-shirts.
And he provided the essential trivia, showing the depth of his research, even for something as simple as a cartoon theme song.
He detailed the character's origins, an animated superhero mouse created by Terry Toons. He tracked the character's evolution, providing the costume details, starting with a blue costume and a red cape, and later changing to the famous yellow costume with a red cape.
Wow.
This focus on detail is what sets him apart. He also connected this obscure history to modern technology, noting that Apple had named their wireless mouse the Mighty Mouse. It's the perfect blend of high and low culture.
Then we had the full anthropological breakdown of Yogi Bear.
This was an extensive historical and cultural analysis. Yogi Bear, the fictional anthropomorphic bear created by Hanna-Barbera, debuted in 1958 on the Huckleberry Hound show before getting his own show in 1961. But the key cultural insight he provided was the origin of Yogi's personality.
Which was a direct lift from 20th century comedy.
Correct. Yogi's entire persona and verbal cadence were based on Art Carney, who famously played Ed Norton on The Honeymooners. That's the kind of structural knowledge of 20th century entertainment that BFO delivers constantly. It's not just noise, it's a history lesson.
And he expects his audience know the foundational knowledge of the Yogi universe.
Exactly. The required trivia included knowing that Yogi lived in Jellystone Park and that his catchphrases were, "I'm smarter than the average bear," and "Hey, boo-boo." This segment is his weekly cultural literacy test. Are you as informed about the obscure foundational pop culture of the 20th century as I am? It's another way of reinforcing the in-group identity.
Right.
This section is the engine of the chaos, showing exactly how Big Fatty used the voice letter system to generate explicit, bizarre, and boundary-pushing content. He relies entirely on the sheer unscripted nature of his callers to feed his content cycle.
The voice letter is the moment where the chaos completely breaks through the structural rigidity. Mm-hmm. The first example this week is genuinely unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
The call from Sharon Fluids, the self-proclaimed safe sex church lady.
This call is the perfect encapsulation of the show's brand confusion and the risks inherent in radical sharing. Sharon had apparently heard rumors floating around the internet that Big Fatty Online was actually a C site specializing in content for big ladies.
She actually called the voicelet number to inquire if the content was suitable for her safe sex education use.
She needed specific clarification, asking if the site featured big ladies on it having sex, or if the content was simply geared towards big ladies. She was attempting to vet him as an educational resource, mistaking the show's name for its description.
Wait, a safe sex church lady thought this podcast was a porn site.
Yeah.
We need to spend a moment here because that level of profound confusion perfectly encapsulates the show's brand risk and its bizarre appeal.
It shows how far the reputation, the ruined ethos, traveled, sometimes completely stripped of context. BFO's clarification was immediate, hilarious, and served to both correct the record and introduce a new layer of explicit in-joke.
How did he handle the clarification?
He assured her, "There are no big ladies on this interweb site," but then he added the perfect, subversive BFO twist, stating, "However, every once in a while, a big lady does come and listen, and I believe her name is Archer."
Oh my gosh.
He uses the most explicit, potentially controversial content, the rumor of a porn site, as a launching pad for a network feud and an internal joke directed at a peer. The boundary pushing is constant.
That's masterful. It manages to be both honest and completely inappropriate simultaneously. We also got a dose of theater gossip mixed with truly inappropriate aesthetic suggestions regarding his planned direction of the play Biloxi Blues.
Kevin B. from QCast called in regarding the auditions scheduled for July 20th and 21st. The core issue is that the play requires male characters to be shirtless military recruits. Kevin suggested, with zero irony, that the audition process should legitimately require the men to take off their shirts and do push-ups.
Why push-ups?
To vet their physique, obviously. Kevin wanted to ensure they weren't casting a saggy-titted army kid, blending high-stakes professional theater direction with network gossip aesthetics and a complete lack of filter regarding physical judgment.
Wow.
It's an explicit request to blend aesthetic judgment with casting reality.
It's the same philosophy applied to reality TV. The aesthetic quality of the performance must be high, even down to the muscle tone of the extras.
Exactly. And the ongoing network drama was never far from the surface. The obsession with the iPhone, which was a recurring theme in the network at the time, also popped up when a listener called in to ask about a specific rumor regarding BFO's weight.
What was the listener's query?
A listener from BC congratulated him on hitting 50 episodes, but asked why Archer, who keeps popping up as the target of these jokes, thought BFO was only 5'7" and 165 pounds.
Okay.
Which is a weight roughly 100 pounds lighter than the show implies, obviously meant as a slight or a joke. But Big Fatty's focus wasn't on the weight rumor.
It was on the device the caller used.
The moment the listener mentioned using an iPhone, Big Fatty's immediate reaction was to deliver his signature, multi-layered, irreverent verbal dismissal of the expensive status symbol technology. Finger, finger, finger. The tech status symbol immediately triggers his anti-consumerist, anti-tech stance, overshadowing the personal insult about his size. It's a deflection that reinforces his brand as an anti-status symbol warrior.
Speaking of network gossip and feuds, BFO actively created drama by playing a clip of his peers' technical failures, turning their struggles into his content.
He played a clip from Archer's show Always Archer, describing it as a train wreck due to the Skypiness and all. He then urged listeners to hear it so they would know the exact specific definition of a train wreck in the technical sense.
No.
This is BFO, turning a network peer's technical difficulties into must-listen commentary and a learning experience for the audience.
He's not subtle about the ongoing network tension either. It's constant and unwavering, evident in the discussion around Chef Mark.
Sklody called in asking for Chef Mark and joking specifically about a Golden Showers group show that Mark was missing. Big Fatty noted that he played this message before Chef Mark had been on the show recently, proving that the high-stakes gossip, the explicit humor, and the network tension are a constant, unchanging pillar of his content. He uses their personal lives as material with their implicit permission.
And even his neighbor, Eric, who lives a block and a half away, had to participate in the listener-only week, demanding his participation be validated.
Eric called in specifically because he was a listener long before I was a podcaster and demanded that his call count during the listener-only week.
Right.
Proving that even internal network figures had to respect the rigid listener-first structure. Big Fatty confirmed that Eric's call did count, but couldn't resist joking back, offering Eric some help and understanding stimulation if he needed it.
Of course.
It's that blend of friendly intimacy and immediate, explicit, suggestive humor that defines their relationship.
But the ultimate piece of boundary-pushing chaos came from Jeremiah in the Samoa Cookie saga, which wrapped up the week with truly bizarre, provocative content. This is the moment where the ruined ethos is fully validated by a listener contribution.
Jeremiah called in with a very dramatic, drawn-out voice letter, thanking Big Fatty for enjoying the Girl Scout cookies he had sent. He was very meticulous about the delivery details, explaining that the mysterious rubber band was to hold all three boxes together.
The rubber band detail is key. It's the mundane detail that grounds the upcoming absurdity.
Yes, the mundane precedes the spectacular. After the cookie delivery details, Jeremiah launched into a completely unprompted and deeply sarcastic historical satire that pushed every single boundary.
Let's detail that satire, because the language is highly provocative, and BFO plays it completely straight.
Jeremiah informed him that 144 years ago, General Robert E. Lee broke his sword in Alexandria, Virginia, effectively ending the Civil War. Jeremiah then delivered the satirical punchline with a noticeable Southern drawl, instructing Big Fatty to congratulate your colored coworkers today on their freedom.
Wow. And the final line cemented the theatrical sarcasm.
He confirmed, "We have our flags at half mast here in Mississippi. It's a sad day for us." That moment where BFO airs an overtly political, racially charged, and deeply sarcastic history lesson provided by listener completely validates the show's commitment to unfiltered content.
Absolutely.
He embraces the content, however provocative or boundary pushing, because it is authentic, unscripted, and theatrical.
It's the ultimate acceptance of the ruined ethos. It creates that sense of shared mythology with the audience. Nothing is off limits, provided it's delivered with personality and theatrical commitment. He doesn't edit or apologize for the content his listeners send.
He treats it like a piece of found art. It demonstrates his commitment to platforming the community, even when that community is expressing deeply controversial or inappropriate sentiments through satire. The structure holds, allowing the chaos to flourish.
Okay, let's zoom out now and synthesize the core structural elements that enable this daily content generation. We started with the paradox. Now let's define the mechanism, starting with the host's fixed life.
The host's life is defined by consistency, driven by mundane, necessary routines. He shops weekly at his preferred grocery store, the Vons East, and he usually does this on Wednesdays.
And the reason for Wednesday is essential to his persona, isn't it?
It speaks to his underlying frugality, which contrasts beautifully with the theatricality of his performance. Wednesdays are senior citizen discount days at that particular Vons East.
Right.
He embraces this frugality, confirming his genuine love for coupons. This blend of domestic routine, economic consciousness, and high theatrical drama is crucial.
So we have the thrifty former Broadway performer who is committed to senior discounts. That contrast is fascinating. But the real content mining strategy isn't the shopping. It's his daily exercise routine.
Yes, the daily nipple walks, as he terms them. This isn't just about staying in shape. He walks between 5 and 7 miles every single day around his neighborhood, which he affectionately terms Fat Acres.
Okay.
Following a very specific known route called the Big Circle.
Why is this walk a content mining strategy rather than just exercise?
Because it is his dedicated daily window of observation. The consistency of the walk ensures that he encounters repeatable people, scenarios, and environments, allowing him to accumulate the small daily stories, observations, and grievances needed to fill the 20-minute daily slot. He knows he has to feed the beast, and the walk is the primary feed source.
That structural consistency feeds his social ritual, which acts as the foundation for his weekly structure.
The foundation is Friday at Fatty's, his weekly social ritual with his core reliable group, Granny, Durwood, and the Nip. That stable, reliable core group provides the human backdrop, his real-life supporting cast, against which the weekly chaos is set.
Right.
They are his sounding board, his audience, and often the subjects of the most intimate stories.
And it's this foundation, the fixed shopping, the fixed walk, the fixed social gathering, that allows for the radical intimacy and disclosure of his private life.
Absolutely. The audience knows intimate details that most people wouldn't share with their closest friends, let alone thousands of listeners. This includes the highly public knowledge of the affectionate name of his bedroom, the love chamber, and his refusal to wear underpants.
Right.
With one highly specific and hilarious exception.
The underpants rule is a perfect example of BFO's commitment to detail.
He only wears underpants if he has a doctor's appointment. That level of sharing turns passive listeners into active, knowledgeable participants in his most private daily decisions. The audience isn't just listening to a show, they're living adjacent to his life.
This intimacy is reinforced by the specific linguistic shortcuts that act as a shared membership badge for the community. The BFO lexicon.
Knowing the lexicon confirms you are part of the inner circle. If you don't know the terms, you don't fully belong. Essential terms include the technological replacements like turtle for computer, the domestic terms such as bruffus for breakfast.
And the playful holiday terminology is critical.
Absolutely. The holiday terms elevate the mundane into the theatrical. Gay crema for Halloween and the wonderfully verbose celebration of exiting the birth canal for birthday.
We also had the geographical replacements that substitute specific names for community-specific code words.
Lost wages is Las Vegas, and Hura serves as the umbrella term for the leather community he is a part of. That community often meets at the Horror Hotel, which is the affectionate, deliberately theatrical nickname for the Metropolis Entertainment Complex in Augusta, Georgia.
Does creating a private lexicon serve as another boundary that reinforces the in-group, out-group membership, paralleling the listener-only week idea?
It absolutely does. It's a linguistic barrier. If you join BFO, you have to learn the language. It forces immersion. It reinforces the exclusivity, making the listener feel like they are accessing a secret world. And their commitment is validated by their ability to understand the inside jokes and the codified language. It's the ultimate form of community building through shared vocabulary.
So let's bring it all back to the final philosophical contradiction we started with. Consistency versus chaos.
The consistency, the fixed 20-minute daily format, the fixed segments, the weekly rituals, the mapped-out walks, doesn't make the show dull. It does the opposite. It provides a sturdy, predictable, unwavering framework that gives the host the complete freedom and the necessary security to share those highly personal, often chaotic, and deeply intimate details without ever destabilizing the show's overall existence or alienating the audience.
The structure enables the intimacy. The show is fundamentally a performance of ruin, turning every part of his life, the shopping, the bodily functions, the decade-long acting career, the relationship status, into content, thereby creating a shared, robust mythology with his audience that spans almost two decades now.
It's a genius model for sustaining a daily show because it balances the need for reliability with the listener's need for novelty and shock. And that final closing sign-off, which we hear at the end of every episode, good gosh and gamey, perfectly blends the polite Southern manners, the good gosh, perhaps inherited from those Southern New Mexico roots,
right,
with his explicit, unapologetic identity, gamey. It's the whole paradox wrapped up in one sign-off.
That structural discipline is everything. And it leaves us with a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over. The show thrives entirely on turning consistent, predictable rituals, like walking or grocery shopping, into essential content.
Mm-hmm.
The structure enables the intimacy. So consider your own daily routine. What consistent, predictable piece of your life could become the reliable canvas for building a connection, for building a dedicated community? Perhaps the performance of consistency itself is the real secret ingredient to captivating an audience.
A fascinating idea to chew on long after the last file is downloaded.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the world of Big Fatty Online.
I'm Gil.
And I'm King. Crucially, tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.